start with two ideas to do with not so much Sfiras HaOmer, but the entire idea of counting 49, 50. We find it both by Sfiras HaOmer and we find it by Shemitah and Yovel. So there's interesting Kli Yoker. The Kli Yoker derives or compares the counting of Shemitah and Yovel, 49 years, with the idea of Sfiras HaOmer. And he says that just like the Torah was given after 7 weeks, 49 days, the 50th day, that set the pattern that the concept of Matan Torah was every 50. So every 50 years, Eretz Yisrael, and subsequent every 7 years really, Eretz Yisrael gets Kedushas Har Sinai. Becomes like Har Sinai. Just like, what's it called, Har Sinai was the animals couldn't go there and it became, overgrown or whatever with vegetation. So he makes the idea of Shemitah and Yovel dependent on Sfiras HaOmer.
Which reflects back to the question in Rashi, why in Shemitah?
Right. No, he's going on that. And he says, therefore, Shemitah and Har Sinai have a connection that the 50th year and subsequently every 7 years in that cycle, right, we have a reminder of the giving of the Torah because of the Eretz Yisrael becomes like Kedushas Har Sinai. That's what he says. There's more to it also. One of the purposes of Shemitah and Yovel is to give people a chance to learn Torah that they didn't have during the regular year. He says, the Gemara says that even people who learn the 2 months a year that were busy either planting or gathering in their crops during Elul, you think Elul was the month that they couldn't learn, and Adar. Those 2 months where they were very busy, planting or harvesting. So 2 months a year they weren't able to learn. So if you have over 6 years, you have 12 months. So Shemitah makes up for those 12 months of not learning by having a year where you can't be involved in agriculture and you learn for the whole year. He says, on the other hand, there's still, I don't remember how he figures it out, but even during the Shemitah year, there's still things that you can do that that come out that you can't have, don't have learning, so you make it up every 50 years. I don't know exactly how that works out. I have to remember.
It makes up for the
Shalati
board, you have the extra months.
So could be. I don't remember, but he figures out. So it's connected not only to Kedushas Har Sinai, Matan Torah, but actually being able to learn the Torah extra. That's what Kli Yoker says. The Marashah has a different idea, just the opposite, that Shemitah and Yovel, right, Sfiras HaOmer has a connection to Shemitah and Yovel, the opposite. He says like this, he's going to explain the Gemara in Moikot in a very difficult Gemara. The Gemara says that once a person has lived most of his life, so he's pretty much guaranteed that he hasn't strayed from the path, that unless he does something on purpose, he's pretty much guaranteed that he'll stay on the straight and narrow, he'll stay on the right path. And he says, then the Gemara says, so what's most of your life? So I would say 36 years. Torah lifespan is 70 years. Or 120 years, so maybe 61 years. What is the Gemara to say most of your life is? 52 years. 52 as the life of Shmuel HaNavi. Shmuel HaNavi lived 52 years. So it's obviously a very big question. How is 52 years considered most of a lifetime? Right? It's not most of 70 years, not most of 120 years. Right? It's the best, it's a lifetime of 103 years. Where does that have any connection to anything? Says the Marashah the following. Says a person's lifetime is a Torah lifetime, 70 years. Right? You can live more than that. Of those 70 years, the first 20 don't count. Because it says a person's really not held totally responsible in the eyes of heaven until he's 20. So that leaves 50 years. He says if you split those 50 years into three parts, right? So you have 16 and a fraction for each part. when you have a majority of 2/3, would be at the 33rd year. Meaning, what's it called? Meaning, if you add those 32 years to the original 20, it'll be after 52. The beginning of the 53rd year is already 2/3 majority. Not a simple majority. So comes out that 53 is the majority, 2/3 majority of the 50 years of a person after the first 20. So in my shit comes out to be what's the 33 years is a 2/3 majority after the first 20. So if you add it to the first 20, you come out to be 52, meaning after 52. That's how he says. He says that's the significance of Lag BaOmer. Because he says the counting of the Omer also follows that same pattern. He said, according to Rabbi Yoshua, the world was created in Nisan. But that doesn't mean it was created on Rosh Chodesh Nisan, but 6 days earlier, on the 25th day of Adar. So if you count 20 days from the 25th day of Adar, you come out to be the 15th day of Nisan. That's the first 20. The next day starts the counting of 50 days, which is like the person's life that you start after 20. When you get to the 2/3 majority is on the 33rd day, which is 53rd day from the beginning of the count of the 20 years. So they mamash go together. And the same thing goes, except he doesn't say what the corollary would be by Shemitah and Yovel of the, what's it called, the 20 years before. But he says basically people count the 50 year active lifetime. Every 50 years we start counting again. And we don't have a connection with Sfira, with Shemitah of the 20 years that don't count, right? But it's more like the 50 days that do count. There also, the 33rd year would be something special according to this, but I don't know of any reason why it is. So that's the, and I was thinking that comes out that we're really counting all the time. Our entire life is counting, and that's what it says in the Pasuk. Limnos yomeinu kein hoda. The Rebbeinu Shem gave us the ability to count our days. So every week, we count to Shabbos. Right? We don't use a week of days with names, but with numbers. Yom Rishon, Sheni, Shlishi, LeShabbos. So we're counting toward Shabbos. Every year, we count towards the giving of the Torah. Right? Every year we count towards the 7 years and then 50 years. So our entire life, days, what's it called, events in the year of weeks and years, we're constantly counting. So our entire life is one of counting the time, because it both represents the idea of preparing for something, and our entire life here is a preparation for Olam Haba. So we're constantly counting up. And we're counting also to occasions in life or whatever that are significant along that way. So that's an interesting idea also with this 50 and 33 and that Gemara that says that the majority of a person's life is 53 years after 52 based on Shmuel HaNavi. Okay. Well, there's something else to do with the Shemitah. It says, if you'll ask, what are we going to eat in the 7th year, meaning after the 7th year, right? Because we haven't, what's it called, planted and plowed, and what are we going to eat? And the Rashi says it's talking specifically about where it's a double Shemitah, where you have Shemitah and Yovel together. So the Rosh Hashanah says, don't worry, in the 6th year, I will give you enough Tvua to last you for 3 years. So you'll have 3 years to eat, and the 3rd year, which means after Yovel, after the 50th year, you'll be able to plant, and the next year you'll have what to eat. So you'll have enough food for the 3 years till you'll get your own crop. So the Sfarno says, that's if you ask, and you don't have bitachon that the Rebbeinu Shem will take care. You ask, you know, what am I going to do? What if you don't ask? Right? So he says, if you don't ask, you're getting bigger bracha. What's the bigger bracha? That you won't have 3 years of crops. You'll have 1 year of crop, but it'll last you for 3 years. Now the question is, why is that a bigger bracha? Why is that a bigger bracha? So I have a few ideas why it's a bigger bracha. First one, God tries not to do open miracles as much as possible. Because open miracles, even though they are very stunning, okay, and impressive. But if you think about them, they can be the opposite of honor for God. Why? Because God created a world, and He said, and when He finished creating it, it's Tov Ma'od, good world. Okay, that means the natural order that God created is very good. Whenever you see a miracle, you could make the mistake to think that the natural order wasn't so good. You needed an amendment. You needed a change. That means what God made to begin with wasn't so good. So it's really not like that, because all these changes are built into the system. They're nothing new, right? Just like the Ribbono Shel Olam made a Tanai with the Yam Suf, that it would split. It was part of the nature. And all miracles are just nature that we don't see often. And all nature are miracles that happen all the time. So there's no real difference, but it looks bad. So therefore, the Ribbono Shel Olam, unless there's a tremendous lesson to be learned from a miracle, the Ribbono Shel Olam does not do miracles. In fact, the Gemara says, "Ein nehenemi ma'aseh nisim," miracles that happen just like this, you don't have any, get enjoyment from it. Right? The Gemara said that certain miracles happened of what's it called, that they were able to get tvua in a time when there was a drought and a famine. Right? It came down from the clouds. They weren't allowed to have anything to do with it, because you don't benefit from miraculous things. Like I said, because it could lead to a negative understanding. In addition to that, the Gemara says that I think it was Rav Yosef. Because Abaye used to remind Rav Yosef of the fact that he didn't learn his Torah. He forgot his Torah. So it says there was a man that, what's it called, that in fact I saw another medrash, a medrash plia, that wasn't stam a man. It says a man, what's it called, his wife died, and she left him with a newborn infant. So the Ribbono Shel Olam made a miracle, it's Gemara in Shabbos, that he was able to nurse the child. The man. Man was able to nurse the child. So Rav Yosef said, wow, how great this guy is, that God changed nature for him and made him able to nurse his child. And I think Abaye said, no, how terrible he is that God had to change nature for him. It's not such a great thing that when nature has to change. So you see from there that it's not necessarily a good thing. I saw a medrash that says that was Mordechai, who it says that he omenes Hadassah. He brought up Hadassah when she was an infant, because her parents died. Her mother died at childbirth. Her father died at conception. She was a total orphaness, and there's nobody to nurse her. So Mordechai was able to nurse her. It was Mordechai who was this person. Okay, I remember seeing a Purim time.
Abaye was also the same.
Right, okay. So, in any case, so therefore, one idea is that if you ask the question, so God has to do an open miracle and give you 3 years of crops in 1 year. That's an open miracle. God would rather not do open miracles. So it's a better thing, if you don't ask any questions, you have full emunah, then you'll get the bigger thing and have a hidden miracle. It'll last for 3 years. That's not an open miracle, that's a hidden miracle. From this you can see something interesting based on the following. God deals with us according to our shortcomings, according to our disabilities. He expects from us a lot, but He deals with us where we're holding. The place I always bring a proof to that is the following. Torah says that we're going to destroy the seven nations slowly. Because if you destroy them too quickly, the land will be desolate. You won't be able to settle it at the pace that you're destroying. It's easier to destroy people than settle the land. And then in a desolate land, wild animals come, and you'll be afraid of wild, you'll have trouble with wild animals, right? All the wild pigs and who knows what other animals will come. And so Rashi asks, what's the problem? Destroy, I'm sure God would love to destroy these people quickly. Right? And what's the problem? The land will be desolate, and not be able to settle it as quickly, and wild animals will come. So what? We have a promise that if we keep God's word, we don't have to worry about wild animals. Rashi says, God knew that we're not going to do what we're supposed to do, and we'd have to worry. We're not going to be on the level to not be worried about wild animals, and therefore, what's it called? He's going to do it in a way that we shouldn't have to worry about the wild animals. Okay. I always tell teachers to learn a lesson from this. Imagine a grade school teacher supposed to start teaching the fifth grade the coming year. She works a whole, you know, summer vacation, making up a lesson plan for fifth grade, beautiful lesson plan. She comes the first day of school, and she finds out that these kids are not on a fifth grade level. They wasted a whole year the year before. They locked the teacher in the closet at the beginning of the year and didn't learn a word. And they're basically on a third grade level. Her lesson plan is way above their head. She has two choices. She can say, look, you kids, if you had done what you were supposed to do, would be on the level that my lesson plan is perfect. It's not my fault, it's your fault. Suffer. I'm going to give you over this year my lesson plan, and it's going to go way above your head. Too bad. You're going to waste another year. But it's your fault. Or the teacher can say, look, let's look at the reality. These kids are not on a fifth grade level. I'm going to have to adapt my lesson plan to them, even though they didn't do what they were supposed to do, right? They should have been on the right level, but they're not. How does God function? The second way. The Rebbe Shlomo says, look, I would like to destroy these nations as fast as possible. If you're doing what you're supposed to be doing, there's no problem with that, because you don't have to worry about wild animals. You're not doing what you're supposed to be doing, so tough luck. I'm going to destroy them quickly, and you'll worry about wild animals. That's your problem. No. God accommodates our low level and deals with us at where we are, not where He'd like us to be. He'd like us to be on a higher level. But I'm going to deal with you. We're going to destroy them slowly to accommodate your lower level. That's how God deals. Same thing over here. If you don't ask any questions and you have emunah, so God can give you 1 year's crop and you'll have emunah to last for 3 years. But if you don't have emunah and you're asking, what am I going to eat? If He only gives you 1 year crop, every minute you're going to be worried, well, how's this going to last for 3 years? You don't have that emunah and bitachon. So the Ribbono Shel Olam accommodates your low level and gives you 3 years crop, which is an open miracle, which He doesn't like to do, because otherwise you're not gonna have emunah and bitachon. You're gonna think you don't have enough to eat for the next 3 years. But if you see it in your silo, 3 years of crops, you'll be okay. But you only need that if you don't have emunah and bitachon. You ask questions. So God will accommodate your low level by doing an open miracle, right, that He doesn't like to do to accommodate your low level. That's second idea. Third idea. Simple, right? And that is, you have less work. Right? If I give you 3 years of crops, you have to work three times as hard in the sixth year. If I give you 1 year of crop, right, whatever, right, sure. So if I give you 1 year of crop, you don't have to work so hard. It's a bigger bracha. Another idea, based on the same thing. If you get 3 years of crops in the sixth year, even though it's a miracle, you get used to the fact that, wow, I can get, look how much I could produce in 1 year. The next year, Shemitah is going to be much harder to keep. Because now, I'm not giving up 1 year. I could make 3 years in this, right? I have a landfall. You're not going to think that it's a miracle because of whatever. Right? Look, I'm giving up. Makes keeping Shemitah much more difficult. Because you're giving up what you think now is 3 years of crops. Because if you did it last year, you could do it this year too. So it makes it much more difficult. That's another idea why it's a bigger miracle to have 1 year of crop and not 3 years, is because when you have 3 years of crops, you become more dependent on the physical things. When you eat less, you become less dependent. It's better in this world to be less dependent on material things than to be more dependent on them. So the bigger miracle is, have 1 year, you'll eat a little bit, and you'll be satisfied. You won't be so dependent on tremendous amounts of food or whatever. That is all based on this svarno, that if you ask, you'll get a lesser miracle than if you don't ask. Okay, but I saw, or really heard, from one of those famous Torah commentaries, known as Alan Friedman, another, which I quote him all the time, what's it called, for not just this, some other things also, but this one was a gem. He said the following. He said that if you ask, then you deserve a bracha, because that means that you understand there's a problem, and you're willing to keep Shemitah, even though you don't know what you're going to eat. There's a problem here. A person who doesn't ask is not a big maimon. He's just an idiot. You don't think there's any problem. Right? If you don't think there's a problem, then you don't have a tremendous emunah and bitachon. You're just ignorant of the fact that there's a problem over here that has to be dealt with. If you don't recognize the problem, then you don't get any bracha. Right? Why should I give you a bracha? You're not keeping Shemitah despite the fact that it's difficult. It's not a difficult law for you because you don't recognize the problem. Not because you're a big maimon. Right? I always use that to explain. If I have people who come to me, talmidim, and they want to know if they're ready to get married. A bracha. So I tell them, you're going to get married. What are you going to do, for a living? What are you going to do to be able to eat? So if he tells me, I said, they don't give food out in the supermarket, for free. You have to pay for it. So if he tells me, look, I'm going to sit and learn, and I'll get a kolo check. My wife is I'm going to look for a wife who could also work, and she'll get something. Maybe I'll do some tutoring on the side. Maybe I'll have some family help. And altogether, I'll live a modest existence, be able to make do. You're ready to get married. If the guy looks at me and says, no problem, God will take care of me. Maybe God means his father-in-law or his father. I don't know which God he's talking about, right? No problem. I said, there is a problem. And if you don't think there's a problem, you're not ready to get married yet. So if you don't recognize the problem, you're not a big maimin, right, and willing to deal with the problem and have emunah that it'll take out. If you don't recognize that there's any problem, then you're still an idiot. So that idiots don't get brachas. Right? Remember that? Years ago. It was in the Gan, when we were davening the Gan. We had a shir in the afternoon, and I still remember it. What's it called? And I say it b'shem Amro. Right. So you're getting famous. try to safer. In any case, the tremendous word, I think it's 100% true. That what's it called, if you'll ask, what are we going to eat, and you'll still keep Shemitah. So then you deserve a bracha. You don't ask, you don't recognize the problem, so you're keeping Shemitah, it's no big deal. There's no problem, so why not keep it? That's right? Okay. So let's not get... okay. Okay, so that is the idea of this bracha, right? If you get a bigger bracha, smaller bracha, whatever. Okay, let's go to something else. The end of the Sedra says that there's a difference between a non-Jewish slave and a Jewish slave. A Jewish slave, lo sirden lo beferech le'inecha, you're not allowed to work with a Jewish slave, avodas perech, which literally means back-breaking labor, debilitating labor. So what does that mean? But with a non-Jewish slave, you can do that. Okay. It doesn't necessarily mean you're oppressing the person. What Gemara says, what the Rambam brings down, what is avodas perech? How do you define it? It's a Torah prohibition. If you work with your non-Jewish, with your Jewish slave, avodas perech, you transgress a negative prohibition. So you have to know what it is. So the Rambam says, avodas perech is busy work. Just to keep busy. No goal. There's no end to it, right? When you have a goal, there's an end. When it's just to keep busy, there's no end. You could keep doing it, forever. Tell them to go fill up a bucket, fill up the, what's it called, empty the sea with a bucket. You can never finish. There's no tachlis. Work without a purpose is called avodas perech. That, and you can't do, and a Jewish slave can't do that. It's interesting that that's what we had to do in Mitzrayim. So you don't ever want a Jewish slave to be like he was in Mitzrayim. There we did avodas perech. What does it mean? So the pasuk says that they built orei miskenos leparo. So the medrash says al tikrei miskenos ela miskenos. They were nebuch cities. Paro had them build them on sand, where they didn't have a foundation, and after the cities were built, they fell down, and you had to build them again. They were constantly rebuilding these same cities over and over. And therefore, there was no goal. There was just to keep them busy. Because Paro wanted them to work, not to see any results, and that is debilitating. When you work like that, you just don't have any taste in life. And that explains why Paro, in the end of Parsha Shmos, came up with this crazy idea, if you think of it, right? It doesn't sound like he's an intelligent person. He wants the Jews to work hard. He thinks the Jews are what's it called, have time to think about going free, and this Moshe and Aaron are filling their minds with all this narishkeit. And therefore, they're not working hard enough. So we're going to make them work harder, so they don't have time to think. Okay? So Paro says like this, I'm not going to give you any straw, you're going to have to go get straw, and you're going to have to produce the same quota of bricks that you produced when I gave you the straw. So you got to work double hard. Paro didn't get anything from that. If I was Paro, I would say, you know what? I'm making the quota double. I want double the amount of bricks from now on. So I'll have double the bricks. I'll have, what's it called? What make the same quota, right? And I'm not going to get anything from it. And you're going to have to work twice as hard. Make you work twice as hard, and I'll get something from it too. Now the answer is that Paro didn't stop wanting to make them work. He wanted to make them work where they didn't feel any accomplishment. Because work without accomplishment, that's called perech. That breaks you. Work with an accomplishment, people work hard, and they see results. It's exhilarating. It doesn't break them. It makes them feel more ennobled, because they accomplished something. So therefore, avodas perech is dafka work that you don't see a result. You don't see any accomplishment. You don't accomplish anything. Because you just have to keep working and working the same thing with no results. It's interesting, they say that the word perech in esbash, if you transpose the letters of perech, the aleph to the tav, the beis to the shin, gimel to resh, so perech is pei becomes vav, resh becomes gimel, and chaf becomes lamed. Those are the transpositions. Okay, so what word do you get? Vav gimel lamed, Vogel. Okay, what in the world is Vogel? Says the Mefarshim, for a different reason. They learn something different from it. I'm going to tell you what I think it means. Vogel in gematria is 39. So it has a hint to the 39 malachas of Shabbos. Okay? So, what's the connection? According to what I'm telling you, the connection is beautiful. What was the most purposeful work in the world? The 39 malachas of Shabbos. Those were the things that went in building the Mishkan. So, when you put in these works, you came out with a Mishkan, which was the most biggest accomplishment a person could do with menial work to make a Mishkan where God's presence would be. So the Esbash, the antithesis, Aleph to Tav, based to the antithesis of Avodas Perech, is building the Mishkan. It's the 39 Malachas of Shabbos. It works perfectly. It's mamish the antithesis, the opposite of Avodas Perech. I always like to ask, if that's the case, then women's work is to a certain degree Avodas Perech. Because they work and work and really never see any lasting accomplishment for most of their work. What do? They cook, make meals, right? Usually you don't frame the meal and put it in a museum. You eat it, so it's finished. You have to make another meal, right? They wash clothing, right? Again, they don't, put the clothing on display. They put it on people and who wear it, especially children's clothing. And within minutes, it's as dirty as it was before you cleaned it. So you don't see any lasting accomplishment. The result, you clean the house. Right? If you have little kids, within minutes, it's a disaster again.
Or a husband.
Well, not really. That depends who the husband is. I mean, they have little kids for sure. I remember when I had a lot of little kids around the house, and I would leave the house in the morning and it would be a disaster. I came back at night and it was the same disaster. So I said to my wife, what'd you do all day? She said, what are you talking about? I cleaned this house perfectly. The kids came home from school and turned it upside down again. Sometimes I believed her. But in any case, it's true. So why isn't a woman's work considered avodas perech? The answer is very...
You get satisfaction.
Okay, yeah.
But it's never done. No, but we get satisfaction.
Okay, I'll tell you what satisfaction you get. The satisfaction you get is not from the laundry, from the food, meals, from the cleaning of the house. Those are just means to reach an end. What is the end? Creating a Jewish home. Bringing up children. That's the nachas, right? The nachas is not having a clean house, having clean clothing or whatever. But in order to bring up children properly, you need to do those things too. The long-lasting result is that you created a Jewish home. Yeah, a Jewish home. For you, for your husband, for children, whatever it may be, you created a Jewish home. And that is the result. And therefore, women have to make a decision. Sometimes, if the clean house or the nice meals or the clean clothes is at expense of putting in time for your husband or for your children in maybe more significant things at certain times. Most of the time, having clean clothes and a clean house and nice meals is what's good for your husband and your children. But sometimes a child needs time. He doesn't need a clean house. He needs a mother who's going to listen to him or dote over him or whatever. So a woman has to know that she can sacrifice the clean house and the clean clothing and the nice meal, right, for the more important thing of spending time with her husband or spending time with her children, if that's what's necessary. Usually you can accomplish both. But if it's a question of one or the other, right, many people opt for the first, not realizing that that's not the ikkar. Those are only means to reach an end. The end is the other thing. Spend more time on the end than on the means. That's another idea. Okay. One, do we have time? Yeah, maybe one more thing. Okay, it says you shouldn't cheat people. There's two kinds of cheating. There's monetary cheating and cheating with words. Monetary cheating is, I sell you a book, right? It looks old, right? It just happens to be an old book. It's worth maybe $2. You can get it on Amazon or whatever. I tell you it's a rare book and it's worth $100. I cheated you. You gave me $100 for a $2 book. I cheated you. Or the opposite. I know that book's worth $100. You think it's an old beat up book worth $2. And I buy it from you for $2, cheating you. That's called cheating. That onas mammon. The Gemara says is also onas devarim. So one way of understanding onas devarim is fits this idea of cheating. I walk into a dress store, right? Woman bought a dress yesterday in another store, and she paid a certain amount. She sees the same dress in another store. She's dying to know if she got a good deal. So she walks into the store and she says, "How much is that dress?" Thinking the person in the store thinks that she wants to buy the dress. She wouldn't buy another dress, the same thing. She just wants to know the price. But if she walks in and says, "I bought this dress somewhere else yesterday. How much do you charge for it?" They're definitely going to tell you a cheaper price to make you feel bad, so you'll come buy it next time that they're there. So you don't want them to know that you're not interested in buying it. So they'll tell you the honest price. So you ask them how much the price is. You are over onas devarim. Not allowed to do that. Because you are giving them the impression that you're a customer, and you're not. You would never think of buying that dress. Right? If you could possibly buy the dress, you're just pricing it because you want to price things around. That's okay. But here you know you'll never buy that dress. You have one already. You just want to know the price. You're giving the impression that you are a customer. That's cheating. Because you're taking their time and their interest or whatever. And if they knew that you're not a customer, they wouldn't spend time on you.
Maybe when you find out, next time you should come here.
Yeah, okay. If there's a chance like that, right, then you can do it. But if there's no chance at all, all you want to know is the price to make yourself feel good. You'd never think of buying this thing. Right, okay. So that makes sense. That's called onah, and this is onah. But the Gemara gives other examples of onah that don't seem to fit this pattern. It's a different kind of thing. It's hurting people's feelings. You tell a Baal Tshuva, "Hey, remember when you weren't a Baal Tshuva and used to eat chazer?" Make him feel bad. But where's the cheating? What are you cheating him? You tell a Ger, "Remember when you were a Goy, you used to eat ham? Now, you don't anymore? So you're making him feel bad." Right? That's called cheating. You go to a guy in the hospital and you say, "You must have done terrible things, otherwise you wouldn't be so sick. God doesn't make people sick if they're not, if they're real big tzaddikim. You must be really pretty bad guy." That's also hurting the guy's feelings, but it's called cheating. A husband who hurts his wife's feelings is called an onas devarim. Why? What's the connection? I understand it. Maybe it's prohibition to make people feel bad, but why is that considered cheating? I want to say that the issue of cheating is not that you take the money from the guy. That's stealing. There's something more here. The Ribbono Shel Olam is emes. Emes means what really exists. Sheker means it doesn't exist. It just appears to exist. The whole evil in this world doesn't really exist. Just an apparition that God gave us to have free choice. But eventually it'll disappear like smoke. So sheker is what really doesn't, it's false, means it doesn't exist. That's why the word sheker, everyone has one leg or a point. It doesn't really have a base. There's no basis to it. MS, on the other hand, each letter has two legs or a base. MS is what is substantive, what's real, and Sheker is what's false. God is the ultimate reality. Anything that doesn't really exist and it's false is the antithesis of God. So when you create a false impression, you're creating something that's ungodly. That's the prohibition. If I make this book appear to be rare, or a rare book appear to be regular, I'm creating a false impression. That's what's prohibited. Same thing over here. If I tell a ger, remember what you were like when you were a goy? That's not you. A person who converts like a new person. So his past is not him. I'm making it appear like his past is him. It's a false impression. Somebody who does tshuva is like a newborn person. If I tell you, remember what you used to do when before you did tshuva, it's not true. It's not you. It was a different person. You're a different person now. I'm creating a false impression. A husband and wife are one. I'm not going to hurt myself. If I hurt you, I'm making the impression you're not one of me with me. That's a false impression. I go to the hospital, I tell the guy, you must have really done terrible things, otherwise you wouldn't be sick. That's wrong. Sometimes the Rabbanu Shlom makes people sick for other reasons. Not because they did anything wrong, not because they were Rishoyim. Right? That's what Eve's friends told him. You must be a faker, because if you were such a big tzaddik, you wouldn't be sick like this. Not true. I'm giving a false impression. So the issur of cheating is not necessarily because I'm taking money from you, right? Or in a not good way. That's that we know from stealing. But what's the problem over here is I'm creating a false impression. And therefore, even according to the opinions that say you're allowed to steal from a goy, which we don't hold like. We don't pass them like that. But even according to them, you're still not allowed to cheat a goy. Because here the problem is taking from the goy. So it could be that's not... But making a false impression makes no difference who you're making it to. The issue is the false impression, not who it affects. What you're affecting is the problem. Therefore, it doesn't make a difference who the object is. That's the idea. Okay.
Is that an extent get of like being sparring things on me, or like fiction novels or stuff?
Yeah, except fiction things could be that they arouse you to nice feelings or whatever, and so they have a tachlis. If you know that it's fiction, right, but you're using it in a positive way to relax, to whatever, that's okay. You're not creating anything that you think is, here you're making something false into looking like it's true. If you read fiction novels and think they're true, that may be a problem, but then you have a bigger problem.